For many Japanese Americans forced to live in camps during World War II, baseball became central to their lives. It was a way to lend a sense of normalcy to a difficult and traumatic situation. In 2016, the late Glenn Moberg interviewed two survivors of America's World War II Japanese camps and the historian who told their stories. Portions of that interview, which aired here on Wisconsin Public Radio, are included in a new documentary that was screened this week in Wausau, Baseball Behind Barbed Wire. Today, we're hearing more about that documentary, how it was created, and the stories told with two people who played a key role in its creation, baseball historian Kiri Yo Nakagawa and documentarian Yuriko Gamo Romer. Welcome to both of you. So, Kiri, let's start with you. Tell us about yourself. What's your background? What led you to this project?
Well, you know, Shireen, for me, I feel very blessed because baseball's been in our family for five generations. My grandfather went from Hiroshima, Japan, to the Big Island of Hawaii in Ola and worked at Puna sugarcane plantation, played on Sundays. It was pretty much 7 days a week, but on Sundays they allowed the plantation team to play other plantation teams. And then in 1886, my grandfather comes to the Central California agricultural area and had 40 acres of grapes and then split it with two cousins and then had two sons. My Uncle Johnny was born in 1900, and he became kind of like the Nisei Babe Ruth or the present-day Shohei Ohtani. He was a left-handed pitcher. He was a home run hitter, center fielder. My dad threw a nine-inning no-hitter and for his Carruthers Blue Raider high school team. I was a shortstop. My son was a catcher, and now we have our grandson, Will the Thrill, kind of carrying the torch. So I feel very blessed to have not only the DNA in our family in baseball, but to have uncles that competed with Lou Gehrig, Babe Ruth, Jackie Robinson. And so now we're here trying to kind of continue this legacy. And so I'm very proud to be part of this documentary and the stories of our marginalized, invisible, and forgotten ball players.
Sounds like baseball has been in your blood for a long, long time. Yes.
That's right.
Yuriko, tell me about yourself and what's your background? Where are you from?
Well, I was actually born in Japan, but I've grown up in the United States, so I can speak English. But let's see. My background is that I am an artist. I have been an artist since I was very small. I studied art, and then I went to New York, and I worked in advertising for a long time. And in advertising, of course, you make little short films. And one day I decided I wanted to make films that were a little bit longer and were more interesting than the commercials I was doing at that point. So I went back to graduate school, and I studied documentary filmmaking, and I am a documentary filmmaker.
Wow. Well, thank you for being here and sharing all of this information with us. We've been really looking forward to this conversation. So, Kiri, the Japanese relationship with this sport dates back a long time. I mean, you said it in your own family, but as a whole. So what's the history behind this love of baseball?
Well, when you look at the baseball game, you know, you think about Cooperstown and Admiral Doubleday taking some balls and bats out to a cow pasture. And this was, you know, 1839, and 30 years later, 1872, Horace Wilson goes to Japan and introduces baseball as a kind of at a middle school level of having most of the disciplines in Japan were karate, kendo, sumo wrestling, so individual disciplines. Well, here was a sport that had nine players, but you played with one mind, and we're all on the same page. And so in 1872, Horace Wilson really kind of introduced it to Japan. But because of the internet and the research we've done, Bill Staples, a historian, writer, found that the Yedo acrobatic team in 1872 was here in the United States doing their acrobatics. But that was during the evening. But during the day, they were playing local teams, merchant teams, playing baseball. So, you know, when you look at baseball, not only in Japan, but even here in America, 1872 goes way back. And so that's something that I think a lot of the immigrants took with them when they came to America. They wanted to prove that they were the best immigrants, no matter what country you came from. Maybe, you know, the conversations, the English language was a barrier. But once you got inside the lines, baseball is very black and white. And I think all immigrants wanted to prove that they were the best players in the world, no matter where they were from. So one of our Issei pioneers said that, you know, putting on a baseball uniform was like putting on the American flag. I think with the research we've done, it really goes a little deeper. I think they wanted to prove that we have the five tools, we have the passion, we could be some of the best baseball players in the world.
So who chose baseball? I mean, who decided that baseball was going to be a thing at these camps? Was it a group decision, or, I mean, who thought this up?
Well, it started out that because baseball goes way back in Japan, and the early immigrants brought baseball back from Japan to the United States. And then you had these communities that were sort of spread out mostly over the West Coast in Hawaii. They created these community leagues and networks, and some of how they connected the communities was to play baseball. So it was naturally in the community system of Japanese Americans. So when you get locked up, and what else do you have to do? Some of these kids, you know, they got to play baseball every day, all day long. And it was something that they knew and something that gave them normalcy, pleasure. And like Carrie just said, the American spirit. And it was a way for them to express their Americanism and their American heritage and citizenship. And so it was a natural for them to go in there and just start playing baseball.
You know, the Issei, they have kind of a language barrier when they first came to our country. But baseball for them was a way to kind of voice. And the game is truly that way in today's world. I mean, you can be in the stands cheering on and having your own kids play the game that you loved. I mean, baseball, even in Japan, was on woodblock prints in the late 1800s. They introduced baseball as part of their curriculum. We don't even have baseball in our curriculum. I mean, of course, it's the American pastime. But to see that passion of the Issei, the ones that were born in Japan, and their kids, the Nisei, that were born here in our country, carry on the spirit pre-war. And then to have, a baseball friend of ours, David Davis, he wrote an article for Sports Illustrated. He said it was a field in a desert, but it felt like home. And I think that was kind of capturing the whole spirit of having to go into these incarceration, concentration camps, limited you. So you were able to kind of express yourself not only for your family, your community. I mean, where else would you want to be in a 20 by 100 barrack, separated in quadrants with a rope and a blanket for your only privacy in that searing heat of the desert? We have pictures of it, and they're not lined up 9 deep as the fandom, all the way around from left field all the way to home plate. And I look at that image because I think that, well, I would rather be out there as a player, as a community, cheering on my favorite players or team, rather than to be in that 20 by 100 barrack in that 120-degree heat. So I think it was another example of creating some normalcy, playing a game that you loved, that your parents supported you in, and to give the entertainment and inspiration to the community that they definitely needed it.
It was cramped. It was hot. There were barbed wire fences. What was life like for the people who were living that way for, you know, those years during World War II? Did you get a sense of that as you were making the film?
Well, Carrie talks about this in the film, and he talks about how it was hard. It was frustrating. But they had to carry on. So they built a sense of normal life. There were schools, people worked. They didn't make very much money, but they were paid something. And they had community events. They had dances. They had concerts. They had things going on. There was scouting, and there were sports. Not just baseball. There were other sports, too. But they did these things to give them a sense of normalcy and life. And they also, they needed to keep moving forward. And like the kids in school, it was really important that they continued in school and stuff. But it was also very frustrating because it broke up the family units. And we have some of these guys in the film talking about how there was no sense of privacy. Carrie just mentioned the they would hang blankets to separate the rooms in the small barracks that they lived in. So there were not the walls and the things that they needed. There were not even walls between the toilets. These people had to go, it was latrines. They had to line up and they had to go to the bathroom with other people next to them. You know, that's humiliating. It's horrible. I mean, the showers were like that too. There was no privacy. And then you had this breakup of the families. Like, people talk about how our family used to eat dinner together every night. Well, they had mess halls. And some of the kids probably thought it was fun to be able to eat all their meals with their buddies. But it meant a breakdown of the family system. You know, you couldn't sit down and have dinner with your family.
I remember Rosie Okajima telling me that, especially when it comes to the bathroom situation, that she would go into the bathroom at 3 in the morning and hold it so long that she would get a stomach ache, but she just was devastated to have to share a toilet with no partitions with other, you know, women and girls. So she'd go into the bathroom at 3 in the morning and put a paper bag over her head just to feel privacy, because all the other women decided that that was the best time to get your privacy early in the morning. And to think that she'd have to put a paper bag over her head to feel any kind of privacy, or for even myself. I mean, I've been in sports all my life, so, you know, we were always used to kind of taking open showers, but no partitions and not having, you know, in our family, we always had family dinners together, and I can't even imagine how that would be in a mess hall situation where all the adults sat together, the children sat together, and like Yuriko mentioned, it really broke up the family dynamic.
You're listening to Carrie Yo Nakagawa and Yuriko Gamal-Romer on Route 51. We're having a discussion on the documentary film Baseball Behind Barbed Wire and the stories of the Japanese who were interned during World War II in those camps. I'm Shereen Seward, the one on Wisconsin Public Radio.
When they'd see these brown windstorms coming towards them, the dust storms.
B.I. came and took my father.
I remember, had a barbed wire fence over 6 feet tall.
The trauma, the humiliation that most went through, the denying of your constitutional rights, your civil liberties. Baseball was a way that Japanese Americans could find some kind of normalcy. It's just astounding that they kept the all-American pastime alive, even from behind barbed wire.
What you just heard was a clip from the documentary Baseball Behind Barbed Wire. We're back on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. Yuriko Gamal-Romer and Carrie Yo Nakagawa are our guests today, and we're hearing about the documentary and the sport that kept Japanese Americans going as they spent years in encampments during World War II. Yuriko, I want to ask you about the film screening in Wausau this week. What was the reaction from the audience?
It was wonderful. We as storytellers, filmmakers, we live for these moments. I mean, we were with hundreds of students, mostly high school students, but students over these last couple days. And it's just amazing to have these kids applaud this film and then ask intelligent questions, come up to you afterwards. And there were a couple people that were sharing that they wanted to be filmmakers, they wanted to be historians. It just made me feel like this is why I do this, was wonderful.
What was it like for you being at the screening this week?
Well, Shireen, for me, it's I have relatives and friends that are musicians, and for them, you know, to do live music is utopian. To do for us as filmmakers to have a live audience with a screening, it's the same feeling. You know, it's to be able to engage with the audience afterwards in a Q&A and to hear some of their stories, and because 70% of this country is still unaware that Japanese Americans were incarcerated, and so to be able to come out here to, you know, share our story with Wausau and Wisconsin, and this Walk in Our Shoes program, Colin Hansen, and this is my kind of a reunion for me. I was here 7 years ago with Tetsu Furukawa and Howard Zenimura, and so it really is a homecoming in a way. I grew up in a small farm town, and to be able to come kind of back home to this feeling of my roots in a way, and to share it with such great students in fantastic high schools, with the community last night, it's just, you know, priceless for us. So, you know, we sometimes question our livelihoods or our passion, but when we're able to come out here and share our experiences and our storytelling with, you know, your community, which has always been supportive and been part of it, you know, it's just amazing.
You know, you touched on this. You were here 7 years ago with Glenn Moberg, who hosted, yes, Route 51 from the beginning.
Yes.
And I listened to that program, and I mean, the stories were so compelling. And some of these stories are reflected in your work. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, as soon as we started the film, I started the film in 2020, the summer of 2020, right when we were in the thick of the pandemic. And we were handed a grant, and it was sort of like, oh, what do we do now? And it's a historic documentary, so one of the first things that you can do when you're locked in your house with a computer is to do historical research and archival research. And so I started calling people and emailing people, and Carrie said, you got to call this guy named Colin Hansen in Wisconsin because they did this show here. And so I called Colin, and he said, well, we've got some video footage that we recorded while the program was happening here, A Walk in Their Shoes. It's an amazing program, but this particular show was like finding gold. And then we were told that Wisconsin Public Radio did an interview. So we were sent the audio from that, and all of a sudden, it was like, wow, we have the beginning of a film. We have these stories by Tetz and Howard, the two guys that were the baseball players in the camp. So it was wonderful to have this material.
What stood out to you about Wisconsin when you said you got to talk to, you got to reach out to the people in Wisconsin?
Well, for me, Shireen, it just, we were treated so royally, and had no idea what to experience when we came out here. And to have, you know, Colin Hansen, his father, George, take us around and experience cheese curds for the first time. And
what did you think of cheese curds?
Oh, I loved it. We just had cheese curds
for lunch today.
Oh, fantastic.
But, you know, again, feeling that sense of my hometown, my upbringing, you know, instead of grapevines, you see cornfields, you see rolling hills. And I'll never forget Tetsu Furukawa, who's an expert in haiku poems. He wrote one, he called it A Walk in Their Shoes, Wisconsin, a far Wisconsin, new joy and experience, cows roaming around. And that haiku really was not only a testament to Wisconsin, but it really was to the spirit of Colin Hansen, his dad, George, that really took us around and treated us, you know, like kings. And so it's always an honor and a pleasure to be in their presence and your community's presence.
Yuriko, how many people did you talk to really get this film pulled together? How many stories did you hear?
Oh, my. That's a big question. I mean, I have spoken to librarians and professors and historians. And ultimately in the film, we interviewed Kerry Onakagawa, and Bill Staples, who is also an author who has written a book, a biography about Kenichi Zenimura, and then the stories that Tetz and Howard give us. But how many people I've talked to goes way beyond that in terms of doing research. But I have read books, seen movies, spoken to people, and I can't even tell you how many. It's probably over 100.
What about Howard and Tet's stories touched you the most?
It's always so hard when you're making a film because there are always way more stories than you could possibly include. So there are some of my favorite stories are probably not in there, but they need to fit together as a story in the film. But one of the ones that I remember early on from Tet's talking about how his father was hauled away because his family... Back then, they lived with an outhouse, and that was what they used. And at nighttime, the outhouse light would go on and off. There were 7 people living in that house, a lot of people going in and out of the outhouse. And the Navy saw these lights going on and off from the water, and they thought his father was sending Morse code messages to the Japanese submarine. In some ways, it sounds completely and totally absurd. And then there's a part of me that's like, if the country had just been attacked by Japanese and there were Japanese submarines out there somewhere, you know, the fear would make you interpret things in a way that you wouldn't normally interpret it. But that's why they took his father away, because of these lights that were going on and off.
What are some of the most memorable stories for you?
Wow. Well, talking about Yuriko's documentary, to see her animators, you know, bring the film to life and the music and the interviews, of course. But to see at the end, and it always gets me, but Tetz talks about forgiveness and how there's a picture of Lowell Bailey and Tetz together, and they're the ones that dueled in the camp. The Tucson Badgers from Tucson, Arizona came in and played the all-star high school team, Tetz's Gila River Eagles, and they won. The Eagles won 11-10 in 10 innings. And to see those two together and knowing both of them through interviews that we had, and to hear Tetz talk about forgiveness and how you have to forgive and heal because he felt that he didn't have much longer to live in this earth. And he goes, before I leave, I want to have this sense of healing and forgiveness. With Howard, you know, he was such a great historian as well, and would share stories about how his dad didn't open up his suitcases for 2 weeks and how they probably would have been juvenile delinquents in the camp if it wasn't for baseball, and how baseball has been was such a healing agent, which he took on after the war. He became an all-star and Hall of Famer for Fresno State. Him and his brother played professional baseball for the Hiroshima Carp in Japan. Many of our pre-war players could have played Major League Baseball, but they had the tools, they had the passion, but they just never got the opportunity. So we look at a lot of the players today, like Ichiro, Shohei Ohtani, as inspiration because they're great players. But again, I always look at the barometer that we had great players in the 20s and 30s too, much like them, but they just never got a chance. And so for Howard and Tetz, I think they reflect on what if they would have been given an opportunity to raise the bar at a higher level, at a major league level, which they never did, but they never had any bitterness in their heart, was always, you know, very positive. They used the word Haji a lot, H-A-J-I, which means never bring shame into the family. And so they always will be, for me, an amazing inspiration, much like most of the pioneers that we are very fortunate to interview.
I have another memory of a story going back to Howard talking about the passion that lived amongst them on building this baseball field. So they talk about going out there, and well, they did find a tractor, so they were able to. But they had to pick out sagebrush. They had to.
So the players themselves were building these fields.
Right. They had to go out there and, you know, they had to use screens to take the big rocks out of the sand. And then they, like, dragged a hose out from the laundry facility out there so they could water. And they planted grass, infield, outfield. This is out in the desert. And a castor bean fence. And they went and, like, they found the lumber piles, and they would, like, borrow lumber. He would say steel lumber. And they would sneak it around and hide it and haul it out there. And, you know, I could tell it was just the passion and the energy that went into building that field. They were proud of it. And that was all part of what made the baseball such a big deal.
When you talked to some of the people who survived these camps, and was it hard for them to talk about it?
Well, I think a lot of, in our culture, they suppress a lot of their feelings. But by the same token, I think when you mention baseball, a positive aspect of their life, you know, they are very positive about that aspect. Getting into the negativity part, the harshness of desert life, of having your home, your business, your ranch, your education taken away, your constitutional rights no longer worked, your civil liberties were all already gone. So I think that part they suppressed, and that's kind of been part of our culture. But some of them, I'm very fortunate, my parents were very open. Any question I asked, they were right there to give me the, you know, highlights and the lowlights. So I feel very blessed that I was able to ask a lot of questions and get all my answers, you know, pretty much answered.
I'm curious about the games themselves. Like, who did the coaching, and how did they get their uniforms? What's the story there?
Well, I always like to talk about the women. You know, the mothers. You know, they took the mattress ticking and got very creative and made the uniforms, and with stencil, with paint, the logos on the jerseys. Money raised would be basically, ironically, they had Folgers coffee cans at the barbed wire entrances, and people would drop in their quarters and nickels and dimes. Kenichi Zenimura, who was very innovative and kind of the father of Japanese-American baseball and built this field of dreams on the Akimel Otham Peeposh River people's sacred land of the Pima Indians, he would ask for more donations to get a box seat, because they developed little bleachers and areas where you wouldn't be totally in the sun. So they took flour and used that as the chalk lines. They made the, as Yuriko mentioned, the 10-foot castor bean home run fence like Wrigley Field. So they were so innovative and creative. I mean, they raised the money where they could. And imagine furnishing 32 teams in three divisions just at Gila River alone.
That's just incredible. So it really was a whole camp experience. I mean, everybody was involved in some way.
I love that they made uniforms out of mattress ticking. It's so creative, and it's so recycling and re-upping and, you know, all that stuff that we like to think about today.
Exactly.
One thing I want to really mention, too, on the Pima Indian sacred land, Kenichi Zenimura put a wooden home plate together, obviously because they didn't have money initially to have bases. They had to make shift and make everything. But that home plate on the sacred land of the Pima Indians was dug up by relatives that got to visit that sacred land of the Pima Indians, and it was donated to the Arizona chapter of the JCL, and it ended up at the National Baseball Hall of Fame as one of our few artifacts that was at the museum. And it's such a great home plate that traveled with the exhibit called Baseball as America. And other than the hate letter for Hank Aaron, the home plate, the two artifacts were the most compelling of that huge tour, Baseball as America. And it represented not only Japanese Americans, it represented the Pima Indians, and it represented, you know, a symbol of hope for both communities. And even the Akimel Otham Peeposh River people, said that because of this home plate, our two cultures are linked forever. And I never saw a connection between Japanese Americans and Pima Indians, but when Mary Thomas, who was the governor of the Pima Indians, declared that, it really gave me a sense that we all are connected through humanity. No matter what our faith is, the color of our skin, we all truly are connected.
You're hearing Kerry Yo Nakagawa and Yuriko Gamo Romer with us today on Route 51 talking about the documentary film Baseball Behind Barbed Wire and the stories of Japanese Americans interned during World War II. I'm Shereen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Guadalupe, California. It was a farming community. There was a lot of Japanese that lived over there. Baseball was played every Sunday. Father would pack up the kids and we all end up at the baseball diamond.
It was universal. It didn't matter what your skin color was, your faith, what country you came from. I think all the immigrants wanted to prove that they were the best in the sport. Putting on a baseball uniform was like putting on the American flag.
What you just heard was a clip from the documentary screened this past week in Wausau. We're talking about that today. We're back on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. Kerry Yo Nakagawa and Yuriko Gamo Romer stay with us for the rest of the hour to continue our discussion on the documentary film Baseball Behind Barbed Wire. Yuriko, before we had a break, we were hearing about, you know, this spirit, that this connection that that the people had who were behind barbed wire, and baseball brought it all together. I guess for you as a filmmaker, how did baseball really embody the spirit of the Japanese American people to kind of endure and persevere despite what was happening to them?
Well, to really explain it, you have to go back to 1872 when baseball went to Japan, and it's 150 years ago. So baseball has been in Japan almost as long as it has been here. But it's a team sport that they fell in love with from the very beginning, and it's a country and a culture that embraces team spirit, teams working together, and so it was a perfect kind of a sport. And it was actually the first time they had a team sport. So you have a culture in Japan that falls in love with the sport, and then you have people that immigrate to the United States, and they bring the sport back with them. There were some people that actually came to the United States because they wanted to play more baseball or learn better baseball or play more competitive. So you've got this passion in the culture, in the people, in the communities of Japanese Americans. And then they have a time when they're stuck, you know, and what can they do? We can bring out this passion, the love of the sport, the love of baseball, and we can play it out however we possibly can to make us get through this. And they do. And it speaks to the resilience. How are we going to get through these times? I mean, there were some people that never made it through. There were some people that were so depressed that they never made it through. But the ones that did found ways. And, you know, I look back on it and I can't even imagine it. I can't imagine being stuck in a place like that. But it is fascinating to me that the love of a sport can express what you have inside you, your passion, your will for life, and also the connection that they had to being American. It's the all-American sport.
In our culture, we have a term called gaman or gamba teru, which is, you know, the 442, which, you know, here these kids volunteered out of the camps to fight for our country, and then they go on to become the most decorated in the history of World War II as a segregated unit. Their term was go for broke. And so I think when you look at our culture and you trace back to these tragedies in Japan in 2011, the Tokuho earthquake, tsunami, you know, how they were able to, you know, stay orderly and there was no rioting for water or food. I think when we go back to this gaman spirit, this gambateru or haji, H-A-J-I, which in our culture means never bring shame onto your family. And so I think this spirit carried through not only pre-war, but certainly through the incarceration period and then resettlement, kind of the hidden legacies. Not only the internees had to spend 4 years of their lives in the desert, but they came back to probably almost another decade of hatred and hostility because they were still considered enemy aliens. And it's ironic because here were these Americans incarcerated only because of their race. And so for us as a third generation, fourth and fifth now in our family, hopefully I can keep passing on these stories to our kids and their kids so they remember the hardship, the sacrifices that the greatest generation made for us.
Yuriko, what do you think a filmmaker's role can be in making sure that history is recorded and that it's remembered accurately?
It's a big responsibility. And we have to have a passion for the subject because it's a big responsibility and it takes a long time and it takes a lot of work. But I think what happens is that you find a place, a subject, something that really means something to you, and you dig and you dig and you find the people that have the stories, and then you have to edit down so that they fit into the film. And you work really hard with a lot of people around you. It's never a solo journey. I have had lots of people working with me, camera people, sound people, artists, illustrators, animators, and we all work together and we create this thing that's a film, and then we hope that it goes out there into the world and actually shares the history in the way that we want it to. And it's a lot of work to get it to a point where it has the integrity of the history and the stories that are being given to you, but also does it in a way that doesn't put people to sleep, hopefully.
Right.
So, yeah, that's what we do.
What I love, Shireen, about being a filmmaker, a storyteller, because that's what we are, you know, whether you're producing, directing, acting, cinematographer, sound, we're able to take these stories as a storyteller and share it, just like our hunters and gatherers back in the day around the fire. We're doing it on a more sophisticated level, obviously, but to be a storyteller and to immortalize storytellers like Tetsu Furukawa, Howard Zenimura, Glenn, you know, 7 years ago, they were all with us. Now they're with us in spirit. But when we see them on film, on that big screen with a live audience, it's like they're right there with us in spirit. And that's, to me, the priceless part of being a filmmaker, a storyteller, is to immortalize these amazing stories and storytellers.
You spent a lot of time talking with students this week. You were in Edgar, you were in Wausau, you were at DC Everest talking with students. What were their questions like? I mean, did they have an opportunity to interact and ask questions about the film and about the process?
There was one question was, what are all the steps that it takes to make a film? And I thought, okay, I could spend the next 6 months telling you that.
You got a year? Yeah.
But there were questions like, there was one young man this morning talked about the haikus. We included Tetsu Furukawa's haikus in there. There's six of them in there. And they express something beautiful, a poetic way to explain something that mm-hmm. he went through. And so that was brought up. We've had a couple of people ask questions about how many fields are out there and do they still exist? And
one lady talked about how She wanted to be a director. And what processes do you go through? Another kid is a historian. And so to hear these young up-and-coming filmmakers, historians, storytellers, in my case, I always like to share to, you know, we have these great smartphones that you can make movies with nowadays. And to take that smartphone home and record your parents, especially your grandparents' story, because that someday will be, you know, a story you could tell your children, and then their children will have it on camera. So I really stress that whether you want to do it professionally, but most importantly, from a family point of view, get those oral histories from your grandparents, your parents, and show them images. And there might be a story that the family or public has never heard, and pursue it further and share it with the world.
You mentioned earlier that many people don't realize that this happened in our history.
Oh, 70%, Shireen, still of this country are still unaware that Japanese Americans were incarcerated. So I think that's the most important, is the specialized knowledge that this did happen. This wasn't something that was just made up, and people suffered. There was a lot of, last night we had Mr. Kanimoto, who was born at Gila River, and he ended up here in Wausau and loves this state. And you know, being a kind of a minority, right? There's not too many Japanese Americans in Wausau. He just loved the fact that, you know, he was born into camp, and I called him a survivor. Ended up going to Stanford Medical School. I mean, an incredible, intelligent man, and couldn't talk more about his love for Wisconsin and also being a Japanese American survivor.
As a filmmaker, how nerve-wracking is it when a project that you've given your heart and soul to and you've taken so much time with is viewed by an audience?
It's nerve-wracking because the first time you do it, you just don't know how people are going to react.
Right.
And I recently took this for the first sneak preview. The second one was here in Wisconsin, but the first one was at the National Baseball Hall of Fame. And it was the first time it was screened to an audience. Actually, the film wasn't even completed at that point. And we had a guy, the first question, the first hand that went up, and he was choking back tears so much that he couldn't talk. And we were afraid he was having a heart attack. And it turned into this like major emotional conversation. And it was beautiful. And I mean, what I got was that the film has some meaning, some power. But like to have all these kids watch the film and explode in applause afterwards, and then have all these questions, with some of them coming up and asking things like, you know, how do you become a director? I want to be a historian. Another young woman came up and said, I'm a political activist. I want to do this. That's when you know that it was worth every hard moment.
What do you want audiences to take away from this? What do you want them to go away feeling?
I want them to understand that this is something that happened in history. It was a dark chapter of American history. And for all of us that love this country, we want to know that the mistakes that are made are learned from, and that we don't make those mistakes again. And whatever it is that is in the future, we want the kids, the people, to understand that these stories that we have to tell will have meaning ongoing.
There's also kind of a message of hope in the film, too, of perseverance.
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, what do you think people can take away with that?
Well, for me, Shireen, I feel that you know, this is a subject matter that most people don't know about, number one. But two, I think, you know, I always emphasize the greatest generation, the Issei, the Nisei, all our greatest generation, no matter what color of our skin was or what faith we belong to. We all are connected by humanity, and we should learn from the history of our mistakes instead of repeating them, and to realize that, you know, embrace others' cultures, heritage, customs, because there's a beauty in all of it and all that we bring to the table here as Americans. And so my takeaway is to, you know, always show that reverence to the greatest generation that sacrificed so much to give our next generation a better life, and how blessed we are to give our future generations a better life, our grandkids and our great-grandkids, and to share these stories so that they don't happen again, and to share the love of all our experiences as immigrants that came to the country. Because, you know, truly only the Native Americans, the indigenous, you know, are the true Americans. Everyone else immigrated here. So I just love the fact that, you know, this film brings out kind of the whole aspects of this beautiful humanitarian humanity that we share.
Yuriko, what's next for the film? I mean, you screened it here in Wausau, and then there are some screenings that are coming up as well.
Well, so we're sneak previewing here, and now we move on to the world premiere, which will be at the Hot Springs Documentary Film Festival in Hot Springs, Arkansas, which is actually close to two of the camps. But then we have four other festivals scheduled in the month of October, and then beyond that, I'm not sure. I mean, we hope for a very robust educational distribution, because this is a film that I really want to have go to schools.
Will people have access to it at some point?
Yes. Yeah, so we actually already have an educational distributor that will be taking it on. And anybody can find, I think if you go to baseballbehindbarbedwire.com, it will lead you to the pages that can direct you to what the latest is in terms of what it's doing and where it's going.
We'll put a link on our page as well, wpr.org/route51, for people who want to learn more and you know, want to find out how to watch the film.
Can I just say one more really short thing?
Yeah.
One of the things that made me want to make this film and include Tets was when he made that comment about we need to have forgiveness in our hearts. He was close to the end of his life, and he knew that this forgiveness was something that he needed to have. And I thought, wow, that's an amazing thought. And that was something that I learned from, and that I hope other people learn from too, was that there are times when we are wronged, and if we can turn around and forgive, then I think it's a big step for the world.
Thank you for adding that. Well, we'll be watching and we'll be keeping track of your work. And I want to thank you both for being with us today and sharing all of this great information about this film and sharing your work with us. It's been a wonderful conversation.
Thank you, Shireen.
Thank you.
You're listening to Route 51. I'm Shireen Seward, extending one more time a sincere thanks to our guests, Yuriko Gamo-Romer and Kariyo Nakagawa. Our producers are Joy Ratch-Kramer and Ezra Wall. Our executive producer is Rick Ryer. Rick is our on-air producer today. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. You can hear the archive of today's program, as well as our previous programs, at wpr.org/route51. There we'll also have a link to information about the film we discussed today. Thanks for allowing us to be a part of your day.
Gila Camp Sunset. Glorious colors spanning. Desolate desert.
Baseball kept us alive as far as I was concerned. Otherwise, I would have been probably a juvenile delinquent over there. Because we were only 15, 16, 17 years old.
We need to show the positive aspects of our history and the negative. And I think when we talk about incarceration during World War II, it's such a negative subject matter because America imprisoned their own Americans only because of their race. And we can't learn from history, or we can't heal unless we acknowledge the mistakes that we've made.
It's amazing what the family went through, but myself, I think that we have to have forgiveness in our heart. I know when I was young, of course, I didn't like what the United States did to us in our own country, et cetera, but I don't have that much time left, and I think that this word forgiveness means a lot to us as we grow old. And if we don't have any forgiveness in our hearts, we won't have a peaceful end when we leave this earth.